We're doing Lie algebras. Any questions from the previous lecture? No. Okay, so I'm just gonna push this over. Okay, it doesn't work. Okay, Lie algebras. Let me just remind you where we more or less stopped last time was we had discovered that the commutator of two generators of a Lie group is actually a linear combination of the generators of the group. We said these numbers here, F, are called the structure constants. Okay. Just want to stress out one thing. This is a relation that holds in general, so it should be true in any representation of the algebra. Now, we're going to be talking about dimensions of representations, so let's make one thing clear. The indices A and B here take values from 1 to whatever the number of generators is. So this is something that doesn't change from one representation to the other. If a group has so many parameters, say SU2 has 3 parameters, it has 3 generators, and in every representation we should have we should be representing 3 generators. However, in a specific representation, every XA will now be a matrix.
So last time we said that the Lie algebra was also a vector space.
Mm-hmm.
But how did we know that to begin with? That like the different generators could be like
they form a vector space.
Yeah.
We define the vector space that they form.
Okay,
we take them to be a basis for a vector space.
Okay.
Yeah. So every generator is going to be a matrix, let's say with indices I and j, and now these indices will take values from, let's say, 1 to the dimension of the representation. Okay, this is just something to keep in mind. And again, in a specific representation, the generators are acting on states. I should also say this. So they act on states. Let's call them psi I. And I again is going to take the same values. So these states form a basis for the space on which these operators act. Okay. This is hopefully dry, but maybe I should start here. Something that turns out to be very useful is the Jacobi identity. Which is true for commutators. So you can check that the commutator between one element and the commutator of two other elements plus all the cyclic permutations of this is equal to 0. This is a property of commutators because because of the definition of the commutator. But now this implies something very interesting for the structure constants. So you may want to check that this implies that F, B, C, D, F, A, D, E plus F, A, B, D, F, C, D, E plus F, C, A, D, A, B, D, E is zero. Here we are summing over the index D. So this is the Jacobi identity in terms of generators. Sorry, in terms of structure constants.
Does this require that there be four generators?
No, this is for any number of generators. Why are you thinking of four?
Well, because, oh wait, no, you go all the way to E, so five. I mean, suppose you only had A, B, C, then would you just cycle around from D and E? Never mind.
So to get this, you have to add indices to this relation. So, for example, one term here will be something like XA, XB, XC. You have to add indices to this to get that. But this is going to be true for all B, C's, D's, and E's.
Right.
OK, this is a useful identity. Now, where I want to get at now is the adjoint representation. You will see what this is. So let's start by defining matrices. Let's call them TA. So I'm going to define, I want to use a letter for the number of generators so that I don't keep writing number of generators. Let me call this capital M. Okay. So let's define M matrices TA with entries TA EC equal to minus A F A B C. So these are M by M matrices. Now, basically what I'm going to show now is that these matrices form a representation of the algebra. To see this, we are going to use the Jacobi identity. So if you calculate a commutator between two of these matrices, TA, TB, and let's write it explicitly. Let's write the indices of this commutator explicitly. Let's say these are C and E. So what I mean here is TA, TB, CE minus TB. TAC, I'm going to be perhaps skipping very, very small steps here, but this can be written as minus F, A, C, D, E. So this is through the definition of the matrices TA of their entries. And now you can check that through the Jacobi identity, you get that this is equal to minus F A B D F C D E, which is the same as F A B D F D C E. And now this is I T D C E by definition. So I'm going to rewrite this as I F A B D T D C E, which shows that this is precisely the algebra we want to represent. It says that T A T B is equal to I F A B C T C. So we see here that this is a representation. And it is called the adjoint representation. So given an algebra, we already have a representation. Just one second. We already have a representation. We know how to create m by m matrices that form a representation of this algebra. Question.
How do we know that the structure constants are asymmetric on the first two indices?
Okay, I should have said this. Good question. We see it straight from here because this is a commutator and this is a standard commutator. We know that xb xa is equal to minus xa xb, and from this it follows that f A, B, C equals minus F, B, A, C. Very good. Actually, what we don't know is what happens with the third index. And we'll see it very soon that in some cases, F is going to be completely antisymmetric in the three indices, but not in general. Yes?
So last time you said that something to form a representation has to reproduce the group multiplication.
Mm-hmm.
But now we're saying that the commutators of the represented elements correspond to the
okay.
Are those two things equivalent?
So sorry. Thank you. So we are now interested in an algebra and representations of the algebra. Perhaps we knew nothing about groups and somebody just gave us this algebra and we wanted to study it. This would be a fair approach. However, because we know that this comes out of a group, you can think of these things representing the generators of the group. So the group elements would be e to the I, some parameter, times these generators. That would be a representation of the group. But this is a representation of the algebra.
So is that the general condition or something to form a representation of an algebra? That
of an algebra? Yes. Yes.
That?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
I have a question related to that one. Uh-huh. So here the algebra is endowed with the commutator as a binary operation, right?
Exactly.
So that's what
yes.
You want to preserve with the representation.
Yes. So this is an algebra which has this, the commutator is the product in the algebra, and this is what we are representing. Yes.
The commutator is a particular example of a Lie bracket, right? So
mm-hmm.
I can have Lie algebras that do not have the commutator as their binary operation, right?
Sure. So here we have in the back of our heads that a commutator really means xaxb minus xbxa, but in general you could think of the commutator as a general product. I mean, you could replace this by a star and say I just have what I have is xa star xb is this, and this is a product that perhaps has certain properties, and I build an algebra out of this. Okay, so this is the adjoint representation, and going back to this discussion of what values the indices take, in the adjoint representation, so always A goes from 1 to M, what are the values that B and C take now? Question.
So when you define the matrices M, those indices B and C, they refer to the Lie algebra basis. So it's the matrix TA represented in the XA basis.
Okay, so we haven't talked yet about which is the natural choice of basis for these operators to act on. We're going to go there. You are right.
Okay, so those indices just refer to some basis for the Lie algebra.
Yeah, but let's just say that now we are doing a very naive thing. We're just taking numbers and putting them in a matrix. This is all we're doing right now. Pardon?
We're dealing with just specifically Lie algebras.
Yes, we are doing Lie algebras.
Because that operation can be any, the star is any general.
No. I was saying this is a general algebra. Now, if you want this to be Lie algebra, you have to demand specific properties for the product. It is anti-symmetric in A and B, for example.
And it has to have the Jacobian identity. I mean, the
yes, it has to have that that property and so on. But what we are really interested is in algebras that have the commutator. I mean, for practical reasons, you know, you will be doing. So let me tell you the truth. The main reason behind this course is you will be doing QFT1 and QFT2. And you know, the standard model, what is the standard model? It's U1 cross SU2 cross SU3. You need to know what those groups are. Because you will be asked to calculate traces of operators in the adjoint. And you know, I want you then to say, oh yeah, I know very well what the adjoint representation is, right? This is where you want to get at. So this is what we are interested in.
Another question. Yeah. So I have the generators of my group, right? So if I want to calculate, I don't know, the trace or the determinant, it only makes sense if I have a representation of the...
If you want to calculate a trace, you're referring to a trace of a matrix. So it has to be...
On a particular representation.
On a particular...
Now, the thing is, if that's invariant of the representation I choose.
Well, you will see that it is in this case. The trace, for example, is invariant. Actually, we will see that for SUN, the trace is just zero. And that has to be the same everywhere. Yes?
Sorry, I'm still a little confused about the matrices TA. What space are they acting on? Are they acting on the Lie algebra, or are we just saying they're acting on some M-dimensional space?
So, okay. So you're ready to answer my very simple question, which was, what values do the indices B and C take? What is the answer to this?
1 to M.
1 to M, very good. So these have to act on an M-dimensional vector space. Exactly, it's in the adjoint representation that B and C go. This is so. I'm continuing here with the adjoint.
Okay.
Okay, just write this. So we know from here that the dimension of the adjoint is equal to the number of generators. So for SU2, for example, we said we counted 3 parameters. We have 3 generators. The adjoint representation of SU2 should be a 3-dimensional representation. So if I want to build a basis for the vector space on which the generators of the adjoint representation of SU2 act on, this should be a basis with 3 elements. I should have 3 states there. We will see this in detail. Okay, and as an aside, to keep this for later, if in particular we are dealing with the group SUN or, so usually we use capital letters for the group and lowercase for the algebra. So if we are dealing with representations of the algebra SUN. You will see today in the tutorial that the number of generators is n squared minus 1. So the adjoint representation will always be n squared minus 1 dimensional for SUN, these indices here. We'll all take values from 1 up to n squared minus 1 in SUN. Okay. Let us also define a scalar product for the vector space of that the generators form, not the vector space on which they act, the vector space that they form. So a convenient product to define is product TA, TB, is the trace of TA, TB. And let me just ask again, the trace here, over which indices is this trace being taken? So if I wanted to add, if I wanted to write this as a sum over an index, what would I write here? Can you come and write it? Yeah. Or see? It's easier than saying five indices.
So I guess you have to write a particular matrix. So then just sum over
it. So just to see what you, it's IJJI, right?
Yes.
And you're summing over all of them?
Yes,
basically. Okay, very good. Yeah, exactly. So it's over those indices that we are taking this trace. The indices of not A and B. A and B stay there. And then these two matrices both have some other, thank you very much, Nima. Both have indices, and this is what we are taking the trace over.
I'm kind of confused, what space are we considering? Like, are we considering the space of generators or the space of...
So this is define a scalar product for the space of generators.
So why is it the T's and not X's?
Oh, okay. T's.
Like we defined it already up there.
It's, sorry, yeah. I was, so TA is in the adjoint representation.
So
we're
defining that trace.
Is T are the adjoint.
So we're defining that trace, I'm choosing a particular representation for the generators, right?
So we are in the adjoint.
But. This is a well-defined scalar product for the vector space generated by the generators of the group. Because, I mean, if I choose another representation, it might not be the case, right? Unless they are equivalent, but...
Oh, okay, so the question is whether this would be invariant under representations. I'm not sure if this would be invariant. This is defined.
Probably if I have. Just the answer no. Because if you take the trivial representation, the trace is like 1 or something.
Yeah.
But if you have different non-equivalent representations, probably the trace is not the same in one representation as in the other.
Sorry, let me think of an example.
No, right, I mean, take the trivial representation.
Yeah.
Like the trace is just 1. And then, like, SU2, the trace is 0. So, I mean, that's a counterexample, but it's not...
Okay, so if we take the trivial representation, the trace will be 1 here. Whereas, it's not going to be... quadrants. It's not going to be one everywhere else, of course. So okay, so this is defined for the adjoint. It's not a general statement. Thank you. Okay, now we can always make a similarity transformation just to normalize our basis vectors, basically, to change this into so this is through a similarity transformation. And now just a short definition, compactly algebras. Are the ones which have plus one here. So for a compactly algebra, this is true.
Isn't the definition the same, just the ij indices go to other,
so the thing is, not in every representation this will give you the same answer. So if you calculate, say, t1, t2 in some representation, it will not necessarily give you the same answer.
But it's the same definition, right?
Well, we are defining this for the adjoint.
But that's my question.
I mean, you could define it. Sure. Yeah, you could define it. Yes. 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 Okay. So I was saying, compactly algebras is what we will be studying. Those have a plus one there. An example of a non-compactly algebra is actually the Poincaré algebra. And as I already said, you will be doing that with Freddy. So, you know, I'm not saying that those algebras are not interesting, but we will be dealing with compact algebras here because this is the case for SUN, basically. And now let's see an interesting property of compactly algebra. So,
transformation in what sense? Like within the...
So the generators form a basis in a vector space. I can always rotate them around, take linear transformations so that I make them either orthogonal to each other or just this would give me zero.
Yeah. But why would that change the trace then?
The trace is a scalar product.
You have to normalize them too.
Yeah, similarity normalization here. It's something that you can always.
Sorry to come back to the same thing. For SUN, how many representations do I have that are unequivalent?
Infinite.
I mean, because the similarity transformation reminds me that two representations are equivalent if you can relate them by a similarity.
That's true. So first of all, they have to be, so obviously to relate two representations with a similarity transformation, they have to have the same dimension,
right?
So we are going to build irreducible representations of SUN that all have different dimensions.
Okay.
So these are not related by similarity transformations. Yeah. Okay, so we continue with compactly algebras. And now let's calculate the trace between the commutator between TA, TB, and TC. So we know that this is IFABD trace of TC. And now we said that we are choosing this to be a Kronecker delta DC. So this is IFABC, from which you see that you can write the structure constants like this. There's no big, not a big philosophy behind this. It just follows from the definition of the scalar product. I just rewrote this. But now, if you start playing with the commutators in here, so there are a few steps here that you might want to check later, you can see that this is actually the same as I times the trace of TA, TC, TB, which is the same as minus F ACB. So for compactly algebras, we see that the structure constants are also anti-symmetric in their second and third indices.
You have a comma in your trace as though it were a function of two inputs.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sorry. I should.
Right?
Yes. I'm sorry. I don't know why. I was confused. I mixed trace and scalar product. Sorry. No comma there. Thank you. Okay, so compactly algebras have fully anti-symmetric structure constants. Fully anti-symmetric.
That they are
compact. Yes, I mean, I believe that this you can take all these relations backwards. So I think this should be true. Okay, so what I'm trying to do here is trying to see what, let's say, the simplest possible Lie algebras are. So let me also introduce the notion of an invariant subalgebra. So this would be a subset of an algebra A, so that if I have two elements in this subalgebra, then their product still stays in the subalgebra. And people refer to simple algebras as those with no invariant subalgebras. And a slightly less strict restriction are semi-simple algebras, which do not have any invariant abelian subalgebras. Remember that abelian means commutative. So so talking about abelian subalgebras, I should mention an algebra that I haven't mentioned so far, but in a sense it is the simplest possible algebra, and it is the U1 algebra.
Relate to the compactness of the corresponding Lie group, or is it totally distinct? When I hear compact, I'm just thinking about it.
Okay. It must have to do with that. To be honest, I was looking this up before the lecture and I couldn't find the precise connection, so I can't give you a more precise answer than this right now. For our purpose, let's just take it as this definition.
So, referring to that, the SUNs are usually, the Lie groups are the N spheres, right? Kind of, they can be seen as an N sphere, as a manifold, which are compact. U1 is, for example, the circle.
Uh-huh.
So I guess the notion
so that
is of the compactness of the underlying manifold.
There's definitely a relation, but yeah. Okay, thank you for the nice example. Okay, so U1 is an example of something that could be an abelian subalgebra. So this is an algebra of a single generator. So whenever we see a subalgebra, sorry, I should write this. So any invariant subalgebra with a single generator that commutes with all the other generators is what we call a U1. Of any algebra. So whenever we have an algebra and we find an invariant subalgebra with only one generator that commutes with everything else, we call this a U1. So, for example, if we do have a U1, this will have no signature. It will make no appearance in the structure constants. The structure constants know nothing about any U1s.
So, is U1 like the analogous to the identity element inside an algebra?
No, because it is another generator, but. But you can think of perhaps your algebra has a subspace, and as long as you act with your U1, you're always staying within this subspace. Whereas if you act on this with another generator, you go to another space. Okay, now all semi-simple algebras have been actually classified, and they can be built by putting together simple algebras. And this is where we will get at tomorrow. So we should start by studying the simplest possible simple algebra. So remember that a simple algebra must have fully anti-symmetric structure constants. Sorry, simple and compact Lie algebras should have a fully anti-symmetric structure constants. And what is the simplest anti-symmetric tensor object, whatever you want to call it, you have heard of so far? The Levi-Civita tensor. Very good. So changing again symbols from X's to T's and J's. I can write the simplest possible compact Lie algebra. Okay, so by definition, this algebra has three generators because I and J take values from 1, 2, 3. And this is what Cartan named this the A1 algebra, or as you will check in your tutorial today, this is actually the algebra that the generators of the group, of the Lie group SU2 form. And you have already seen that this is also isomorphic to SO3. Okay.
When you say simplest compact algebra, what do you mean by simplest?
Sorry, this is my own. Yeah. So the easiest, I don't know what kind of word to use here.
Okay.
Is that the compact the algebra of lowest possible dimension? Or wait, no, that.
What do you call dimension? The number of generators of the algebra? Yes, that would be it exactly. Okay, so let's say the
smallest
possible compact Lie algebra, and it is also a simple algebra because it has no invariant subalgebras. Yes. Okay, so the algebras are isomorphic, the groups are not.
Right, but in that transition from the group to the algebra, what is lost?
So we are losing, okay, so this, I think this is where it's useful to think of compact groups as manifolds. We are losing the compactness. Because SO3 is two covers, so that part is lost, the compactness.
That's what the people say, that SU2 is the universal covering of SO3.
Oh, SO3, yeah. But the algebras are the same, so when we build representations of SU2, you can also think of them as representations of SO3.
The algebras are the same. Where do we get, when does the difference come in? Because they're generating it, they should contain the information about it.
Probably it's because
Zeta local. Everything you do in the algebra is Zeta local, in the neighborhood of the identity.
Yeah. So the algebra is like the tangent plane to the tangent space to the manifold. So you can have different manifolds with the isomorphic tangent spaces, but the manifolds are different.
If you consider the Hann space of SF.
we still have a lot of SU2 to do, so let's keep this discussion for later, and let's start talking about representations of SU2. So what we want to do now, so this is what we start with, this algebra. I'm going to rewrite it here, so I will be mostly referring to it as the SU2 algebra.
Okay.
And our goal now is to build irreducible representations of this algebra. So of course, you have come across this algebra in your quantum mechanics course, right? This is usually angular momentum. And there already you must have come across the problem that because these generators do not commute, you cannot diagonalize them all at the same time and thus find your spectrum there, right? So what did you do in your quantum mechanics class? Pauli matrices are a representation of this algebra. So what? How do you find the spectrum? What do you do? So you're thinking of raising and lowering operators? Is this what you mean by ladder operators?
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. Perhaps I just wanted to mention one. I thought that usually in quantum mechanics courses, people use the Casimir operator. So you can find that the sum over all j squared, ji squared, actually commutes with everything, and we use this to build representations. It's okay because if it doesn't ring a bell, it's okay because that's not what we're going to do. I just wanted to remind you of what you might have seen. Okay, so we are going to use the ladder operator. So we can diagonalize only one of those ji's at a time. So let's pick this one to be j3. So what we want when we diagonalize it, what we really mean is we want to work with its eigenstates. So we want to have these eigenstates as bases of the vector space on which the generators of this algebra will act on, right? And remember that we have Hermitian ji's here, right? This was a property of the Lie algebras we saw, of SUN. So because the ji's are Hermitian, they're going to have real eigenvalues, and they will also have orthogonal eigenstates. So the eigenstates of, say, J3 will form a very nice basis in our space. Now, let's assume that we have done this. We have diagonalized this, and we have its eigenstates. Let us pick out of these eigenstates the one which has the maximum eigenvalue. So let's call that particular eigenstate J and J3 acting on it has an eigenvalue J. So we're making the assumption here that we have a finite number of states, and thus we can pick out the one with maximum eigenvalue. And now we define raising and lowering operators. So if we take a specific combination of J1 NJ2, we see that these relations hold. So if you want, this is just the same algebra as U2, rewritten in terms of these operators. Sorry, usually there's not usually, there should be this normalization here, otherwise this will not work. There's a 1 over square root there. You can check these two relations. Now, if M is some eigenstate of J3, with eigenvalue M, then again you can check that if I build the state J plus acting on M, then this is going to be a state of J3 eigenvalue M plus 1. And similarly, if I take J minus 1 acting on M, I'm going to go down to a state of eigenvalue M minus 1. Okay, so maybe I should have said a word about what we're trying to do here. So this is called the highest weight representation of SU2. So the idea is that since we have diagonalized the generator J3, then we are labeling all states by the eigenvalues of J3, by their eigenvalues under J3. And now we see that if we use raising and lowering operators, these two have a very good property. They take us to eigenstates of higher or lower J3 eigenvalue. This is a procedure that now may seem simple for SU2, but it is used in the exact same way to classify all semi-simple Lie algebras. Yeah.
First question, when I did this before, I have never seen the 1 over square root of 2 before.
Okay.
And you are at 2
I don't know why that comes about. And the second thing, regarding the raising and lowering operators, we sort of often pull them out of a hat. What justifies this formulation? Like this J1 plus I plus minus I J2. What justifies the fact that this...
Very good. So what we are looking for here is we are looking for something... This is something that when commuted with J3 gives me back perhaps some constant times itself. Because once I have this, then I have created something that raises or lowers the eigenvalues of J3. So, a small exercise. If you manage to find some x such that J3x equals some constant alpha times x, then if you act with J3 on the state xm, you will get back alpha plus m xm here. If you can find a generator X that has this property. So what we found here was two generators, J plus and J minus, for which have this property and for which alpha is plus 1 or minus 1. Very, very good question, because this is exactly what we want to do in general later on when we have more than three generators. So again, what we will do then is find some generators that commute and say we only have one J3, then we will try to arrange all other generators into combinations that have this property. This is what makes us pick out J1 and J2. And now I'm not sure about my normalization. Normalization to be checked. That. Yes. But I'm thinking where this actually matters. It matters here. Yeah. So this has to be checked versus this relation, because we don't want to have anything here. We want to have a unit here. I'm quite sure that this is right, but please check it. So check.
I have a little question. We have the structure constant, which defines me the algebra in an abstract way. So this is not the representation itself. What you said to be the highest weight representation would be the identity representation on the space generated by the eigenvectors of J3 or something like that.
No. We are trying to build a representation now, so it might seem a bit circular, but we are trying to build a representation assuming that we have a representation. So let's say that we have a representation. What properties does it satisfy?
The homomorphism.
Sorry?
The homomorphism.
Yeah, but I mean, this is... So the idea is, let's assume we have a representation.
Right.
Okay. Let's pick out one state that we're going to call the maximum weight state. So this is called, J is called the maximum weight, highest weight. We pick out that state, and then we try to see how the other operators act on it. So to construct it, okay. Let me make this more specific. Let me say one thing, because I can see why this is not clear. Let's say that we have a representation, and let's say that we have a set of states M that form a basis for the vector space on which our representation matrices act. Let's assume that we have that. We will see that this cannot be absolutely anything. We will place constraints on it very soon. But once we have this, then we know what the representation of our generators is here if we can calculate these inner products. So what we are really aiming for is to calculate the entries of the matrix J3, and this is how we are going to calculate them. So we need to know how J3 acts on the states here. Of course, J3 is easy because we are now decomposing it into its eigenstate, so you know that this is going to be... So, and because we said that this can be, that these are orthogonal and so on, you can see that this is just the question.
So somehow, these are the generators with their structure constants independent of the representation. Now we are saying, what about if we make a representation from the algebra into some GLM, right? Or some group of matrices
of
arbitrary dimension, and you are going to impose constraints on that dimension.
Yes.
As well.
On the dimension as well. Yes. Well, we will see actually that the dimension is more or less the only thing we're going to impose a constraint on here.
Highest weight? Couldn't we do it with the lowest?
We could do it with lowest weight as well, sure. But this is usually called the highest weight representations, highest weight construction. You can. So in the tutorial, I have written out the steps again so that you have them. And in the tutorial, I don't remember now. In the tutorial, I might have actually started from the lowest weight, just to see it the other way. It's completely equivalent. So where we're getting at is we want to know this. Okay, this is easy if we assume that we have eigenstates of J3. But what we also want to know is, say, for example, what the entries of the matrix J1 are. And the raising and lowering operators make it easy to answer this question. So this is where we're going. But let's go back to here. So we've seen that. Wait a second. My God. Okay. So we're here. So this shows us that J plus minus. That the states that are created by J plus minus acting on some state are proportional to the n plus minus 1 eigenstates. And here. So we want to use these operators to build a spectrum. So we can pick. First of all, we can pick our states, as we already said, to be orthonormal to each other. So we can choose an orthonormal basis for these states, M, so that M prime M is delta M prime M. And also, this is fine. Sorry, this is fine. So now, take for example the lowering operator J minus acting on a state M, and we don't in principle know what numbers should appear in front of the state M minus 1 here. So unfortunately, I think I have to skip all this, which means you probably have to do it in the tutorial. But let me just write down a few steps. So a few useful things to do is check that, first of all, for m equals j, where this is the highest weight, you can see that n of j has to be equal to square root of j. What else can you do? Then it is useful to check that j plus acting on m minus 1 gives the same n of m here. And after doing that, you can find a very nice recursion relation between the nm. So you can find that nm squared equals m plus n of m plus 1 squared. And now if you if you solve this recursion relation starting from n of j equals square root of j, then you actually see that n of m is given by 1 over square root j plus m. So, let me try to draw a picture of what we're doing here. Over here, I'm going to put a state j. This is the highest weight state. Now, if I should have said this, sorry. By definition, j plus acting on the highest weight state gives us zero. This follows from the fact that we assume that j is the highest weight state. So j plus acting on j should take us to j plus 1, but we have assumed that there is no state of weight j plus 1, which is just zero. So the raising operator acting on the highest weight state just destroys it. There is a state j minus 1, and a lowering operator can take me there. On the other hand, a raising operator can take me from j minus 1 to j plus. J minus 2. And so on. But if, again, we make the assumption that this is a finite spectrum of states, then there should be somewhere a lowest weight state as well. So let's call this J minimum. And now J plus acting on J minimum will take us somewhere, but J minus acting on it should give zero. So never works. So I want to okay, so what we're going to do next is to use the fact that there is a lowest weight state to actually see a constraint on the dimension of this representation. So we are imposing that J minus acting on some J minimum gives us zero. By the way, I should have said this. You can check that J plus acting on J gives you zero, because J plus, by the way, J plus acting on J is equal to N of J plus 1, J plus 1. And this formula is zero for M equals J plus 1, because this is J plus 1 minus J plus 1. So n of j plus 1 is 0. We're good. This formula is consistent with the highest weight state. Now let's talk about the lowest weight state. And it is convenient for our purposes to call this j minimum j maximum. What do I want to call it? I want to call it j maximum minus l. In other words, I'm saying that there are L steps between the lowest and the highest weight state. So, right, I start from J, one step, two steps, L steps down to J minimum. Now, this requirement means that N of J minus L must be zero. And if you calculate this, you will see that you have to find that L is equal to 2J. Now, L is an integer because L is the number of steps that take me from J minimum to J maximum, right? So you have found here that J can only be a half integer. So you are allowed to build these highest weight representations as long as you pick your highest weight to be a half integer. It cannot be whatever you want. J, the highest weight, can only be 0, 1 half, 1, 3 halves, and so on. This is why people talk about the spin 1 half representation, the spin 1 representation, and so on. This is how we construct those representations. And although so what does this tell us, what does this tell us about the dimension of the representation? What is the dimension of this representation? How many states do I have here? I have L plus 1. Sorry. I have 2J plus 1 states here. This is the dimension of my representation. L plus 1 states, because it's L steps in between. So the dimension of the representation is L plus 1, which is equal to 2J plus 1. So these are the representations that that we can construct. And it is convenient to, or people usually denote the states by a letter J, which is the same within a representation. This specifies which representation I'm talking about, and then the weight, as we call it, of the specific state. So this is the highest weight. Sorry. This is the highest weight. And M is the weight of a specific state. So just to give an example, if I write a state 3 halves 1, I mean that I am talking about the spin 3 half representation. And in that representation, I am referring to the state that has eigenvalue of J3 plus 1. Very good. And now you can calculate the entries of the matrices in the representation. So this is now I can answer this question. I know that J1 is basically given by, oh, I'm going to get this wrong, but it should be 1 over root 2 of j plus j minus mn prime. And I can find the entries of j plus, for example. These are states m prime acting on j plus acting on m. And now I know that j plus acting on m gives me n of m plus 1 m prime m plus 1. And because these states are orthonormal, this is nothing but n of m plus 1 times the Kronecker delta between m prime and m plus 1. So one last thing that, again, I should have said here before writing all this is that there are two things you can do here. You can label, here I'm labeling the rows and columns in my matrices by the values of m, and m actually takes values from minus j to j. Because here we saw that this also means that j minimum is j minus 2j equals minus j. So here you might think this is a bit of a strange way to label rows and columns. However, this is the way we usually do it. So, you know, you might have things like j minus minus a half, for example. They look a bit weird, but I hope we all understand what they mean through here. Okay, so in the tutorial today, you'll go through a few of the details that we missed here, and you will study more as you do. You will write the matrices for specific representations here, just to see that this is something that you can actually do. And our strategy from now on is to apply the exact same construction to other algebras. Questions?
The mention of the representation in this case to j plus 1 implies that I can represent, for example, SU2 in two-dimensional spaces, three-dimensional, four-dimensional, five-dimensional, so I can always have a j that accomplishes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So the one-dimensional would be the trivial representation. Everything goes to the identity. Then two-dimensional will be the spin 1/2, and there we have 2x2 matrices. So this happens to be the same with what we call the defining representation of SU2. So when we defined the group SU2, we were talking about 2x2 matrices. Well, this is, and then we think of the Pauli matrices, and this is exactly what the spin 1/2 representation is. But then we can also build a representation with spin 1, and this will have dimension 3. So this is going to be 3x3 matrices, and so on. Right? So this way you can construct as many irreducible representations of SU2 as you want. Actually, one of the things that I ask you to do in your tutorial, and I think is fun, is just to ask your computer to calculate, you know, I don't know, J equals 8 for you matrices, for example.
So now that you said that it's irreducible representations, how can I see that this is in fact an irreducible representation?
Okay, very good. So we have labeled our states here by eigenvalues of J3. And the way we have done our construction, everything has a distinct eigenvalue of J3. There is nothing else that we can no other label that we can add to our states that enters in this construction.
For example, in the case that my generator has eigenvalue with multiplicity different than 1, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there is kind of a degenerate subspace. That would account for a reducible representation.
Sorry, if J3 has, if you have a degenerate J3 eigenvalue, yes, that would be a degenerate representation, for example. Reducible, sorry, yeah.
So for algebras where you have more than three generators, you also do this definition of J plus and minus with whatever you want?
With whatever. So our strategy is going to be, first we have to find all the generators that are of the form of J3, so things that commute with each other. Mm-hmm. And then whatever else is left, we have to find combinations of those generators that are that satisfy that relation here, so that we can use them as raising and lowering. And we will see, of course, that then we will have invariant subalgebras. So we will see that everything can be decomposed in terms of SU2s. So instead of this picture here where we have states, and there's one state here, one state there, J plus and minus move me there, maybe I will have a whole invariant subspace here. And one SU2 generator will take me from this subspace to that subspace, and so on. This is the way, this is the decomposition we are going to do. I guess I'll see you at the tutorial. Enjoy your lunch.